I think Monica is the way that we all would like to remember our mothers. You know, just, you know, mm-hmm. when we were, you know, David's age, you know, 12, 11,
yeah.
10, you know, our mom was our entire world at that age. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that all four of us are mama's boys. So, you know, and I think that, you know, this is essentially a movie about mothers and sons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
this was something that is actually in Super Toys and other seasons, the last part of the Super Toys trilogy that all of us conceived. This idea of basically a dump truck bringing in these spare parts for robots remind me a lot of some of the more chilling scenes in Schindler's List, mm-hmm. actually, when you have the corpses
of
the dead bodies in Schindler's List. Quite chilling.
This is some of the most interesting makeup effect mm-hmm. work I have ever seen in
and
my
this
whole
is Stan Winston.
Yeah.
This is very much Stan Winston.
But the idea of like combining live actors with this sort of kind of scrap metal look.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily right here, but
yeah.
I mean, there's some really interesting extras on the
DVD.
Bonus
talk
DVD.
About what the, they, how they.
Oh yeah.
Did it's, some of this stuff. Really
most,
impressive.
Yeah.
The level of effects. I mean, this. You know, this was Oscar nominated for Best Visual Effects, deservingly so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of back and forth as to whether I really do believe Fellowship of the Ring deserved the Oscar last year, because after seeing the effects features on the DVD about what level effects and this different sort of effects they use in this movie, I almost would say that this deserved it more.
This is wicked right here.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about, though. It's mm-hmm. just the combination of.
And, you know, a lot of people sort of saw this as sort of Spielberg, a darker look at Spielberg's Amblin moon and the moon in E.T. the Extraterrestrial, that iconic moon you have in there.
Well, the fact of the matter is Spielberg has gotten a lot more bold over the years.
Yeah.
And he's been less and less afraid of, you know, showing or expressing his dark side, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to go for the cliche there, even though I just did. But that's the fact, you know, and you listen to him in interviews, or you know, you read what he said in interviews, and you know he's talking about how much happier he is and how much more complete he feels as a filmmaker now that he has explored his dark side a little.
Yeah, I mean, ever since Schindler's List, he has been a completely different filmmaker. I mean, all you have to do is look at Jurassic Park and The Lost World to know that. I mean, Lost World is considerably darker. But, I mean, I love the place Spielberg is at as a filmmaker now.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
it's absolutely.
I enjoy seeing, like, you know, light escapism from him, like Catch Me If You Can and stuff like that. I love it when he goes to this darker, more bolder material, and because he's really shown that he's quite exceptional at it.
Kubrick.
Well, Tron, too.
Tron, yeah.
I mean, this is more. I don't know exactly who conceived this.
But another really.
It's not the most exciting chase in the world. But I think that.
I think it's more or less supposed to be just kind of like a. Not exactly exciting or enthralling or any way.
Yeah.
In that effect at all, but really more or less just kind of like a. Kind of like a feeling of. Entrapment, almost kind of like mm-hmm. a suffocating kind of feel, like, you know, you're just being led into a trap.
Yeah.
And I think it pulls out that kind of feeling. But again, it's another one of those scenes that just throws your average Spielberg fan completely off guard.
Yeah, especially if you're expecting something along the lines of an Indiana Jones chase scene.
Yeah, you're not in
you
which
know, this isn't. You know, this isn't a major set piece, people. This is a. I mean, this is just an ends, a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is basically just a way of getting him, getting David and Joe into the Flesh Fair.
Right.
But,
yeah, that's
yeah,
pretty neat. It's a real actress right there as well, which is the most
I mean, here, right now in the scoring, we have a little bit of sort of techno...
Electronica
experimentation by Williams, which really does not work well in the least. That's probably the most disappointing part of the score for me.
I was actually
because
kind
of...
I like this piece of scoring.
I really think he could have done.
I like this piece of scoring. I thought it was
integrating the electronica with the classical scoring that we're about to hear, which I think is actually like this piece is classic Williams. I love it, but the electronica parts just didn't impress me at all. I mean, it's very cliched, and it's something. It's great that he could try it, but at the same time, you know, he didn't do as good as I thought.
Was that the first mission of his quest for the Blue Fairy right there front?
That's the first. I mean, he.
Other than reading the story, I guess.
He mentions the Blue Fairy when he's trying to convince Monica not to leave him in the wood, not to abandon him.
Mm-hmm.
But. I mean, that's the first mention of him since then, yes. Of her since then.
Okay. I was going to mention that the piece of the little electronica piece that we hear just a few moments ago was... I was just excited by the fact that, you know, it was Williams experimenting with that kind of musical storytelling. I mean, I was just really compelled by... the idea of it. I mean, I really didn't care that it sounded too much like The Matrix or whatever. I was just really excited and intrigued by the idea that Williams would go in that direction. So, I mean, that's just my two cents. I do like that little piece of scoring.
It's like an all-terrain toy right there.
I think they got cheers in the theater when you made it, I think.
Now, here we go with the Flesh Fairy. Which is...
This is not Kid Rock, by the way. I thought it was.
No, this is Ministry, who...
Okay.
Apparently, Kubrick was a very big fan of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And that's the reason they're in here.
I don't know. A lot of reviews I read compared this to sort of the WWF monster truck thing that you see. But I don't know. Because that's so commercial... And so, you know, like soap opera-ish, this is, there's a bit more, it's like they're abusing sort of the slaves that do work for them, you know what
I'm
saying?
This is one of those things where I really think some of the reviews that criticized this were off the mark. Mm-hmm. Yes, Ron?
I was just going to say that this is where we get into a point in the movie that when I was watching it again recently, I began to realize the parallels between... this part of the story and the Animatrix serials. I don't know if anyone else sees the parallel there.
But I was
really intrigued by the idea that, you know, both of them explored the idea that, you know, as Gigolo Joe says a little bit later in the film, they made us too many, too smart, too fast, something along those lines. You know, and it's along the lines of what the Animatrix serial explores, I think. And I was kind of impressed with myself, I guess, just to say that I was able to realize that.
Yeah. Like I was saying, I really do think a lot of reviews who criticized this scene were sort of missing the point of it. Somebody who I was really gratified that they said that Chris Rock, which
could you shoot me a little?
I didn't necessarily think he was. You need to have somebody like a Chris Rock do that voice.
I thought it was neat to hear it,
but
I thought it was. I didn't think it was a distraction. I think it's neat to like be able to like point out all the star voiceover cameos. I genuinely enjoyed that. And it was something that gave me a shot in the arm every time I started to get a little thrown off by whatever the movie was doing to me.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, here I really think people who criticize this sequence was missing the mark. The point of this is to basically see that the humans do resent the robot, the machine. The humans resent the machines, resent the idea of a machine that is basically being designed to replace them, replace the functions of what humans can do. And, I mean, that's basically the point of this, is just to get a glimpse of that. I mean, we're not, this movie is not exploring in as much depth as, say, maybe a Matrix does. The questions of whether man and machine can coexist. I mean, that's for other stories to do. This is a fairy tale. This is about one machine's journey.
Well, I'm not saying that, you know, the two are connected in any way. I'm not saying that in the least. I was really kind of enjoying the fact that I was able to recognize the parallels between the two.
Yeah. I'm not saying that you were necessarily saying that. I mean, I'm just saying that people who criticize this and criticize the movie for not going far enough, maybe in exploring the idea of man and machine coexisting, they missed the point of the story. Mm-hmm. That's not the point of the story.
Well,
that's not the main theme of the story.
Just another reason the movie didn't find the audience that it probably should have, or it probably deserved.
So David's very traumatized by this, especially when that Chris Rock character was coming in there, because he has no idea that he's not real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like Monica said, I mean, she didn't prepare him for the real world. She didn't prepare him for what he might see out there. So, Arnie, who is the drill instructor in Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, another sort of homage to Kubrick.
Also, the voice of the Army, the sergeant in Toy Story,
yeah,
as well,
and a poltergeist, Army poltergeist in Peter Jackson's The Frighteners.
Now he now has his own reality show, doesn't he? Or no, that's
somebody else.
That's the other. Okay,
yeah.
That's the Army guy from the first Survivor. Anyway,
it's somebody else.
Yeah.
Right here we've got.
See, I know myself.
You've got the first real sense of humanity outside Monica that David is interacting with. You know, the first person in the real world outside of the Swinton household that is really treating David with a certain degree of kindness and sort of has this degree of sympathy for him. And he's just so blown away. This character actually missed what he was saying when he was starting to be taken away. I was influenced by Super Toys into the other season's part.
Pretty horrible stuff.
The Flesh Fair, is basically designed to show the fanaticism of people against machines, sort of the zealots who really just have no love for machines at all.
And I think it's awesome to show you, you know, part of the nasty part of that humans can be, you know, sort of that depth that we can go to.
Yeah,
that's just kind of doesn't make any sense, but it's so destructive.
Well, we were talking about, you know, dramatic changes in tone earlier, and one of the things that is interesting is that the Flesh Bear does not throw me off as much as I thought it would at first, because but the interesting thing is that our first view of humanity is Cybertronics, you know, which is who obviously has a lot of respect for the art of creating artificial intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and we go straight from there to Monica and Henry, who which's pretty well established, their feelings on the entire on the subject,
mm-hmm.
but then we go from that to this, and you know what, this isn't actually one of the things. This isn't really one of the things I really had a problem with, the Flesh Fair. I thought, you know, it was a more dark, morbid part of the story, but it really didn't seem as if it would be something that would turn me off to the idea of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a number of things in this movie that do throw me off, and I will try to point them out whenever they come up, and by any means possible. But this was something that I did find compelling and enjoyed for the most part, and found a lot of entertainment value in.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, again, at the same time, it's something that is not going to intrigue the average movie fan,
mm-hmm.
or your everyday. I don't mean to refer to somebody like that. You know, I don't mean to refer to somebody who went to this movie and didn't expect this as an average movie. You know, more or less, someone who just. What was the crowd chanting right there?
Johnson Johnson, which is the character of Brendan Gleeson, who's basically the ringmaster of this,
okay.
of the Flesh Fair. That's his name. It's not really established in any part.
No, it's not. It's not.
But yeah, that's his name, Johnson Johnson. Brendan Gleeson, who is best known for his work in Braveheart, opposite Mel Gibson and MI2 and some other films.
This is obviously very reminiscent of the sequence in Pinocchio when he joins the. I got no strings to hold me down, mm-hmm. to make me smile, or make. Okay, I'll shut up.
Yeah, wow. We don't want to get sued by Disney. We really don't want to get sued by Disney.
We could get sued by half of Hollywood for some of the things we've already said in our commentaries. Yeah. But.
This is a pretty deep scene because, mm-hmm. you know, he's talking about. I mean, you know, all the people can see is a child.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just very interesting. You know, they're willing to destroy everything else. And, you know, once it comes to kids, that kind of saves them, I guess, in the eyes of the audience. You know, because now they're not destructive anymore.
Yeah, and I like the fact that his reaction,
mm-hmm.
is sort of what triggers this descent in the crowd.
Right.
The fact that they aren't, like you said, they're not willing to believe that this is a machine. I mean, this is the most realistic, and it really does show off the fact that David is a unique machine.
Right.
David is a unique individual in terms of artificial intelligence. I mean, part of the whole basis of this scene is basically just to get David and Gigolo Joe
together,
connected.
Right.
That their fates are basically connected.
Small scene there.
Now he holds the hand, Miller.
Yeah. I like how that's that's sort of a trait between of the friendship that's kept throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have a scene that you get the idea that David, Professor Hobby's son, was the inspiration for David. Pretty obvious way of saying it. You know. Not too much.
Well, again, we were talking about on E.T. The fact that Spielberg does not, in fact, use a lot of dialogue to tell some of the more poignant aspects of his stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know...
Although some people feel he used too much in this movie. I think he uses...
Well, again, the dialogue...
Near the end, I can see it, but...
yeah, I mean, the dialogue is a little... Is a little, you know, dicey at times. I'm not gonna deny that. You know, I mean, it's obvious that, you know, I mean, and this is like for this is I know this isn't the first time since Close Encounters that Spielberg, you know, has, you know, had some influence on the script, but
this is his first
screenwriting credit since Close Encounters, is it not?
Actually, it's his first since Poltergeist.
Okay.
It's his first for a movie he's directed since Close Encounters.
Okay.
But
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
That was Brian. He was rolling out knowledge. I knew Poltergeist was on the other day. That's about it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, as far as... I think, overall, it's a very well-constructed screenplay by... Spielberg. I think it's a really well-crafted screenplay. It really involves me in the story.
Mm.
Perhaps he could have brought in somebody a little bit stronger in terms of dialogue,
mm-hmm.
to punch up the dialogue a bit, make it not necessarily as mundane as it is at times.
But it's at least it's
serviceable for most of the movie. And I really think he didn't get enough credit for this screenplay, was it? Which I felt was quite good. I love the way Jude Law's eyes light up when he mentions them. I mean, this is a moment where... I mean, this is all Jude Law.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just brilliant. I mean, his movements are very much in keeping with how you would see a robot being programmed, this particular robot being programmed,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time you really get an energy that really is only human.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
what I thought was, you know, obviously it's obviously not a direct homage, but the adventure. Inside a forest, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. For some reason, I'm reminded of you know, E.T. and
mm-hmm.
things like that. But the thing is, what honestly kind of almost creeped me out almost is that, you know, we're having this little adventure, you know, in the outdoors and everything, and I'm thinking of E.T. But at the same time, you know, we're all these sexual references and innuendos, mm-hmm. kind of like
that's Kubrick.
Obviously that's Kubrick, but I'm like,
I mean, people said if Kubrick had directed this would have been an R-rated movie.
Oh yeah,
and right. I truly believe that.
Right. It would have been.
I mean, you know, he did Eyes Wide Shut and he did Lolita, which are two of the more the original Lolita, not the remake.
Yeah. Right.
Which are two of the more controversial films, let's say, in terms of sexuality. That was Fred Astaire.
Well, you know, that's the thing, though. That's the miracle of that's the really neat part of Jude Law's performance, mm-hmm. is that he knew that Gigolo Joe wasn't some kind of
mm-hmm.
you know sexual Say you know.
I like the fact that he's a passionate,
but no, he's a, you know, again, he's a romantic, and he's not. No, he's not a perv. He's just.
He's got passion to him that is just infectious.
Mm-hmm. These kids, however, are pervs.
Yeah. But he plays that to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a nice little touch.
How old are these kids, for crying out loud?
I don't know. I know the guy right there was in a movie called Harbor Man with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Now, Brian, is this piece of music, was this not directly influenced by, or this piece of music being in the movie, was this not directly influenced by Kubrick?
That is correct. Yes. This piece, this is partially an original Williams composition, part with, on top of it, a piece of music, Der Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss. Excuse me if I got the name incorrect. Watch the DVD extras specifically on John Williams for the correct pronunciation.
Kubrick wanted that piece of music.
He wanted that piece of music, but he never really
specified
in what context. So, and right now we have Rouge City, which was probably the most influential part of Chris Baker's.
And 90% of this is ILM.
Yeah.
And like only like 10% of it is physical. And that's just what blows me away.
Yeah.
This is so
beautiful. Well, the way they shot these scenes was quite ingenious. The pre-visualization that they did to allow Spielberg to get ideas to what it would look like on set. I mean, the actors would be in front of a blue screen or a green screen.
I think it was blue screen.
I think it was a blue screen.
Yeah.
But, I mean, on the monitors that Spielberg looks at, you saw basically a first-generation idea of what this would look like. And it was actually kind of impressive to get the idea. I love it.
that's
this place is ideal.
right on. Switches it on and off.
Yeah. There's some, from what I've heard, there are signs that said, like, Strangelove, obviously a reference to Dr. Strangelove, and Clockwork Orange is an inspiration on this.
But at the same time, it's just a really fun scene.
Yeah.
It's more fun than it had to have been, I think.
I think the basic idea was sort of like a Las Vegas-type feel to it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or Atlantic City. Probably more Vegas. Here we get Dr. No,
voiced by Robin Williams.
Which, depending on how you feel about this, it either works for you or it doesn't.
And
it's like every other part of this movie.
Very much so. But you know what? And I was somebody who felt as if some parts worked better than others. And this was, in fact, one of my favorite scenes.
For the most part, I mean, this scene works for me as well. I mean, you know, maybe it's a bit over the top, and having Robin Williams voice it. I mean, having some of the vocal cameos that they have in this, I mean, works. Some work and some don't work as well. This one, I think, for the most part, works though. Like I said, the Chris Rock one earlier didn't. Is kind of distracting for me personally, at least.
Well, I think the voiceovers started to become something in the movie that I was kind of looking forward to. You know, when I realized that, you know, they were having fun with that aspect of the movie, I started to have fun with it, and I started to become more involved in the story because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on it. And some of Robin Williams' best work has always been voiceover work. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that line was in Hubert Street. that one too. One of the things we haven't really talked about was is really the Pinocchio reference. I mean, we've hinted at it a little bit, but I mean, you know, there were, you know, throughout the entire development, this was an idea of making the Pinocchio, the use of Pinocchio as basically a story reference for this movie was basically something Kubrick always was coming back to when he first read it. And all this in his foreword to the short story anthology that Super Toys is a part of talks about how Kubrick kept bringing up the Pinocchio and the idea that David should have a
Pinocchio complex.
Well, should have an interaction with the Blue Fairy. But that should be a very specific thing in the movie. And so, I mean, that part is very much inspired by Kubrick's original intentions.
And the scene when Monica's reading Pinocchio to David and Martin is very much an homage to E.T.
with Peter Pan. Although, you know, admittedly, to a certain degree, that worked better in terms of the use of a fairy tale for the story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was more of a subtext than that story.
Well, we talked in the E.T. Commentary was the fact that, or the idea that the believing in fairies and clapping your hands, that bringing them back to life would be an out for E.T. coming back to life at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's what the intentions were here, in a way, you know. According to the filmmakers, anyway, you know, David does in fact become a real boy at the end of the film, it can be argued that the use of Monica telling the story of Pinocchio to the boys at the beginning of the film could be, in a way, an out for David to supposedly, in fact, become a real boy at the end.
Well, I don't know if I necessarily look at it that way. I mean, a lot of people have a problem with the fact that the Pinocchio template was so thickly laid on in this story. But, I mean, and a lot of people actually compare this sort of to a deconstruction of the fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
In the same sense that Hook was supposed to be. But
regardless of that, Brian, don't you think he was using it just to show that the boy learned to imagine? I mean, to have an imagination?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I don't have a whole lot of problems with the making the Pinocchio inspiration that implicit. I have no problem with it because I get so engrossed in the story. I mean, it's a compelling story. That's why it's a classic. You know, this is basically a variation of that story in a new context. And that's part of the reason why I think that so many people were off base when they were criticizing this for putting, you know, the fact that they're basically putting the emotional core of this movie in the our emotional investment in a machine. People were missing the point that this was metaphorical. It was not intended to be literal. Yes?
And also, you know, most people's takes on fairy tales now are, you know, the Disney animated films, and you know what? The original takes on these fairy tales are considerably darker than Disney ever would have intended them to be.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And so therefore, you know, most fairy tales, most original adaptations of fairy tales are much darker.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? And this in a way, that I think that is another reason why this movie threw audiences off, is because, like, well, if it's inspired by Pinocchio, why isn't there a happier context to it? And, you know, well, you know why? It's because, you know, Grimm's fairy tales were,
yeah,
in fact grim, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the Disney Snow White, and I've seen a live action version of Snow White done several years ago, and they are very different.
Yeah, and
in tone, the first one is more in keeping with Grimm's Grimm's idea.
You know, in Hans Christian Andersen's version of The Little Mermaid, she dies at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The Little Mermaid dies at the end, and, you know.
Yeah.
But they're not going to put that in a Disney film.
No, of course not. Here we have another use of
electronica, which I continue to appreciate for its not necessarily its originality, but its boldness.
You know, I mean, well,
it's bold for Williams anyway.
It's bold for Williams, and I mean,
it's just exciting to hear him experiment this way.
Well, I mean, if you know my opinion on film scoring, I'm all for experimentation. In fact, I welcome it with open arms. I love it when I hear something new and fresh. The problem is, I don't feel like this is fresh enough. I mean, it's experimental for Williams, because we've never really heard him do this type of writing before, and it's laudable in that sense, but at the same time, it's very cliched in the way in what he comes up with. It's
although,
very cliched, which I found disappointing, because I expect more from him.
Although, Brian, you said that Williams was robbed of the Oscar this year.
You're the one who thought Williams was robbed of an Oscar. Fellowship of the Ring was my choice.
Right.
I just think he was more worthy of an Oscar for this than he was for Harry Potter.
Okay, well, okay, then that's...
And right, we've just bypassed one of the shots that I was going to definitely point out, which was the World Trade Center building still being standing even in a submerged New York, which was one of the ideas that Kubrick came up with when he was working on the story with Aldous. And he actually consulted with Dennis Muren and one of his collaborators over at ILM, flew him over to England and actually spent Thanksgiving Day with them just talking about visual effects, what was possible in visual effects, and off and on, like he was with Spielberg, was basically talking about the possibilities of this story with them in terms of visual effects. And it was really interesting to read about that after his death.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a good article in Entertainment Weekly on it.
I'm able to appreciate the beauty of this sequence now, mm-hmm. but I mean in theaters when I was experiencing this for the first time, I was just too busy trying to figure out, you know, how I was supposed to be following. I was too busy trying to figure out the story at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, this was a point in the film when I began to feel as if, you know, well, wait a second, what kind of movie is this supposed to be? And I was not able to appreciate the absolute gee whiz quality of this of this sequence, which is just absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah, and I mean, this is truly one of the most spectacular visual movies. This is one of the most visionary movies from a visual standpoint, I think, that's ever been made. I don't know if I would necessarily put it in the same league with 2001, which is in a league of its own, along with probably the original Star Wars movies, but certainly this would probably be one of my top 10 in terms of most strikingly visual movies that's ever been made. And this scene right here, I mean, is just very awe-inspiring in terms of what ILM is capable of. and in a certain degree, it actually surpasses some of the work, I think, on the Star Wars movies. But here we have a scene that you could almost see as an inspiration from a 2001 scene at the very end of the movie where one of the characters confronts a different version of themselves. That's about all I'll say at risk of spoiling the movie. Suffice to say that the ending of 2001 is probably the most surreal ending ever. This is definitely in that vein.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the scene where, you know, we're about to lead up to the scene where David really realizes who he really is. This is sort of the self-realization of this character. And the music John Williams writes is very
haunting.
Haunting and inspired by Ligeti, the composer most frequently used in 2001 by Kubrick. Very atonal music, very dissonant music. It's quite striking, and it goes beautifully with the visuals.
Haley Joel Osment's performance here is quite moving.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you really get a sense of fury and ferocity of this from his point of view. And the fact that it scares Gigolo Joe, I mean,
yeah, that's
that this rage scares him even is something that I think is important.
And look at William Hertz, the way he interacts with the mecha that was, you know, inspired by his son. You know, mm-hmm. You can really tell, you know, the...
There's really something fatherly about the way he interacts with David.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really quite heartbreaking. And this is when I really started to feel as if the ending wasn't as organic as it could have been.
The ending. I've had so many complaints about the ending.
Oh my god.
Well, I mean, we all have our own opinions.
And we'll get to that when the ending.
But, yeah, when the place we all know.
But you know all what we're talking about.
But I definitely feel as if, you know, I mean, we're 2 hours into this sucker, and mm-hmm. there is no sign of a happy ending.
Right.
No.
And,
which,
you know, I mean, okay, fine. You don't have to have a happy ending to every film, every movie, every story does not have to have a happy ending. Mm-hmm. But let it feel more organic than it does here.